Nightlife with Philip Clark
on ABC Radio.
Well, can people really change? Changes. Turn and face the strange. Changes. Don't tell them to grow up out of it. I wonder, seriously, life events can change us, and victories and traumas, and we change as we get older, whether we like it or not. But what about actually willing ourselves to change? If you're the person in the household who never picks up after themselves, who never helps around the joint, even though you're told to, how easy is it to change that behaviour? If you are not a good listener, for example. If you're someone who always looks on the negative side of life, if you're a glass half full person, how do you change that? They say it takes 3 weeks to create a habit, but when we're talking about deeper parts of our personality, it might seem a whole lot harder. I wonder whether you've changed an aspect of your personality or behaviour, and how did you do it? And did it last? And do you think certain types of behaviour are innate or even genetic? 1-300-800-222. Joining us tonight for a look at this, I think, intriguing topic is clinical psychologist and author of Change of Thinking, Dr. Sarah Edelman. Sarah, good evening. Welcome back.
Hi, Philip. Good to be back.
Great to have you with us too. How common is it for people to want to change aspects of themselves?
Look, it's extremely common. And I think most people, when they stop and think about it, would probably identify something that they'd like to change about themselves, whether it's just perhaps eating a bit less or...
Oh, that one.
Well, I mean, it's probably a very common thing, or just getting into more regular healthy lifestyle habits and so on. But yeah, probably most people want to change some aspect of their routine or personality.
Mm. What are some of the common things that people would like to change? You mentioned eating.
Yeah, well, healthy lifestyle behaviours.
That's probably the most common.
Probably the most common. Healthy diet, regular exercise, perhaps getting into good sleep routines, doing things like meditation is common as well, or wanting to. Not that people necessarily do it, but they mean to, or they would like to. The other thing is physical appearance. So for a lot of people, weight. It's wanting to lose weight. But also for some people, and women perhaps more so than men, it may be things like wanting to get bigger boobs or thicker lips or collagen in their faces or false eyelashes or
seriously suggesting that women are seriously dissatisfied with the way they look, are you?
Well, it's partly a stage of life thing. I mean, I think at certain times of their lives, it's probably more of an issue than other times. But yeah, look, it's certainly common.
Do you think it lasts all through life, or is that aspect? I mean, what's that expression? The ship has sailed.
It depends on personality, and I think it also depends on things like insecurity. Your level of inner sense of security will affect how desperate you are to compensate. So if you feel intrinsically insecure, often the compensation is either through trying to be beautiful or really focusing on physical appearance, or it may be through success, and it may be through work success or standing out in some ways. Mm. The other area that people often want to change is overcoming addictive behaviours like smoking or screen time or alcohol or gambling. Yeah. And then, as you said a little bit earlier, things like just wanting to be a more positive person, wanting to manage anxiety or wanting to overcome depression or episodes of anger.
Yeah.
So personality aspects.
I guess also people often want to improve their social interactions with other people too. I mean, people would like more to be perhaps the life of the party. They're worried all the time when they go out that, they're too nervous to speak to people, or they feel that no one likes them. There are very few of us, I think, who go into a crowded room with not knowing many people and feeling all that confident.
Yeah. And in fact, my niece was telling me about her little 5-year-old who she was taking her to a party, and the 5-year-old said, Mummy, I'm a little bit scared. What if nobody talks to me? And I said, well, actually, isn't that interesting? Because that's the sort of thing that we perhaps worry about right through to our late adult lives and sometimes beyond. Yeah. So social behaviour is actually a common area that people sort of identify as something they'd like to change about themselves. And as you say, it might be, I wish I was more more outgoing, more confident, more friendly, more assertive as well in relationships. Or I wish I was a better communicator. I wish I could express myself more. Or I wish I was more comfortable just chatting to people without sort of worrying too much about what they think. And for some people, it's also about changing a relationship, a particular relationship that they have with, for example, it might be with a partner, or it might be with one of their kids, or it might be they want to change relationship with a stepchild or somebody at work that that they just don't get on with and is an ongoing threat. So yeah, that desire to improve relationships with other people is another common area that people want to change.
My texter says, a man never wants his woman to change, but a woman always wants to change her man.
I mean, I'm not sure how true that is.
But
certainly
are,
it's not a bad, I mean, it's not an unusual thing for somebody to say, look, when she first met me or when they first met me, you know, they thought I was perfect, and then all they've tried to do the whole time since we've been together is, you know, she's tried to change me or she's wanted to change.
Well, we might get onto this in a moment, but that's true because you're not the person I married, the cliche. You've changed is a thing, isn't it? Because in a sense people do naturally change over various stages of their lives.
Yes, and in terms of like relationships, sometimes we overlook things. When a relationship is new and still exciting and magic, we sometimes overlook the fact that this person seems to be perhaps a little bit crotchety or irritable or not very nice to my friends, and we kind of overlook it. But once we're in a relationship with someone for a long time, some of those things become more problematic, and therefore there might be more of a sort of a pressure to try and change them.
I know it's an observation been made before, but that's the sure sign that a relationship is on the rocks, isn't it? That things you once found amusing in a person now irritate you.
And look, I've got to say, I'm just looking at my own relationship. I've been with my partner now for over 40 years, and when I first met him, the thing that really impressed me was that he was such an independent thinker. I mean, very bright and completely indifferent to social. Like, he wasn't socially self-conscious, whereas I was at the other end. And to me, that was such a sign of strength, that he really didn't care what people think. But over time, it became a real problem. And he also complained that over time, one of the things I was trying to do was try and make him a more socially,
adept.
And I have to report he's much, much better now. He's sort of filed off some of the rough edges, which I take credit for.
What are the can you ask Sarah for her view about, this is Michael from Victoria, from Healesville in Victoria. Ask Sarah about her view about the ability of autistic people to change. Whatever the difficulty for normal people, is it harder for autistic people to change, or even impossible? I have strong indications that I'm probably autistic or have Asperger's, and wonder if it's even possible to change some of the autistic tendencies, which have really enormously damaged my life over decades.
Yeah, look, I think it's really tough, and you know, as the person said, it can be tough for people, you know, who are sort of not neurodiverse. But yes, you can change, but it is harder, and I think a lot of it is understanding, so self-awareness, learning about self, learning to understand self better, connecting with other people who are neurodiverse and finding out how they manage, often support groups or being involved in just even Facebook groups and finding out about how other people manage is useful. And sometimes getting support through professional help is also can also be good.
Yeah. So, I mean, just this business of ageing, I mean, age does create changes, we know. What sort of changes? I mean, do we all become more, I don't know, do we all become more cranky and and introverted and cautious and inside ourselves as we get older?
Well, actually, the opposite is true, Philip. And in fact, if you go towards later age, we actually become more psychologically healthy, which is totally counterintuitive. Yeah. I mean, look, different stages of life, we have different, I mean, I guess we behave differently. We have different traits at different stages. So if you think of yourself, how you thought and behaved and felt as a child, and then you compare that to when you became a teenager and then when you became a young adult in your early 20s. And one of the things that really changes people is having children. Suddenly you are no longer the most important person in your own life. You've got other little human beings that depend on you. And having children makes people more compassionate. It makes people more patient. It makes people more focused on other rather than themselves. But very often as we age, we become a little bit more confident. I've often spoken to people who describe themselves as socialized introverts. So they, you know, I've heard people say, look, I used to be terribly shy when I was younger, but just over time I've become a little bit more relaxed with people and I can engage with people and I can actually go to social events without worrying about it. And as I said, once people get into their 60s and later life, their mental health often improves.
That's right. It's a happiness curve, isn't it? And the happiness curve goes up.
Totally counterintuitive, because you'd think you'd have more reason.
Closer to death, you'd be more worried about things.
Yeah, and also more things going wrong physically. You're getting more aches and pains. You're not able to do as much. But, paradoxically, we feel better.
Jade says, hey, come on, men want to change women too. They want them to be slimmer, dress more sexily, keep their hair long, et cetera.
Totally, I think it's. I guess you can't generalise.
I guess that's right. What about the effects of relationships? I mean, do relationships with others make us change?
Yeah, I think people, well, especially if you're talking about long-term relationships, I think we kind of mould. If you're in a partnership relationship for a long period of time, if it's a good, healthy relationship and there's lots of communication, you sort of you often become more compassionate, you're empathic, you understand the other person better, you often with a good relationship, both of you grow. People say in a good relationship, it actually enhances your self-esteem. I remember what was the movie with Jack Nicholson, As Good As It Gets, where I think it was Helen, I'm trying to think of her name. You know, she said to Jack Nicholson, you know, tell me one good thing about me. She wanted him to sort of, because he was very self-focused, and he said, you make me want to be a better person. And I actually think that's actually quite true in good relationships. It actually does mean that people become more compassionate and better people to their partner and hopefully to others as well.
See, I was talking with a friend of mine a while back, and she said of her partners, the relationships that she'd been in, she said, the thing is we generally become more and more like each other. And start wearing each other's clothes, not in a bizarre way, but we you sort of share everything, wear each other's clothes, and you sort of become so much like each other that often that's what gets boring about the relationship, and hence she said that's why she and I had to move on. She said I had to move on for that reason. Okay. But I was thinking that's. That might be true of all relationships.
Yeah.
That the longer you spend together, the more alike you become, do you think?
I think if it's a sort of harmonious relationship, you often are moulded, you share values, you discuss things, you kind of share opinions. Very often you do have a lot in common. And in a good, healthy relationship, people also have their own separate interests and their own, you know, perhaps their own views on certain things. But it's probably true that we do influence each other's. And usually, and if it's a good relationship, we're influenced in a positive way. If it's not such a good relationship, it can make us more... perhaps less trusting, it can make us more uneasy, it can make us more unhappy as well. So it can work either way.
Mm. Mary says, is it because as we get older we lose brain cells and therefore don't worry so much? Mary, I'd hope not.
It would be interesting to understand the biology. I mean, I think there's a biology of what causes that to change as well as the social.
I don't think you get more dopey as you get older necessarily, Mary.
Well, I mean, sometimes you do. But, yeah, you know, some people would argue it's just adaptation. We gradually adapt to the world around us. We perhaps become a little bit more flexible with our thinking. But that's not true for everyone.
What if one person in the relationship wants the other to change? Here's the rub, isn't it? Does that work?
Look, again, it depends on the type of the relationship and whether we're talking about partners, as in life mates, or even within a family situation. I'm frequently contacted by, say, a parent who's totally beside themselves because one of their kids spends their whole life on screens and is perhaps not going to school or is not doing things, not having a normal, healthy social life. And it can be devastating to witness, particularly if it's one of your children, but it can also be very devastating to witness when it's a partner who is gambling or who is an alcoholic and who breaks out into sort of violent outbursts or who has, you know, who has a violent temper and affects, and that may affect not only yourself, but it may also affect other family members and children and so on. And I guess it depends on the nature of, you know, the behaviour. But at some stage, I mean, communication is absolutely essential. I mean, the first step, it doesn't necessarily fix things, but it's the first step is to sit down, to talk to the person, to ask them what they see, you know, how do they think they're going and what do they see the future as being. If it's another adult, you need to talk about the consequences. You need to talk about how it's affecting yourself and the rest of the family. And at some point, you've got to try and, you know, if it's important or if it has a really serious negative effect on the whole family, you know, it's got to be a joint problem that you work through. And if they're not willing to do that, at some point, you know, you need to look at sort of separating.
Mm. Your thoughts on change, is it possible? Jill from Gympie. Hello, Jill.
Hi, Phil, and hi, Sarah. Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I've had negative behaviours that I've had for probably 20 years that I've tried many different ways of changing, doing and this and that, and then thinking, oh, this is a terrible character flaw I have. And what I have discovered is my behaviour was being driven by prescription medication that I was being fed for 20 years.
Right.
So I think we really need to be careful about, you know, always blaming the psychology. Look at what's being put into your body, you know. I mean, you know, I looked up this drug and Pfizer have paid out billions in compensation and yet it's little known that this has this effect on people.
Right.
It's called an impulse control disorder. I won't go into which impulse mine was out of control, but you know, it was horrible because I thought, oh, I'm an insidiously flawed character, you know, and I wasn't. So yeah. I just like to bring that up.
Yeah, thanks, Jill.
That is actually, Jill, that's a really interesting story. And I mean, people do have impulse control disorders, which are not necessarily medication driven. But either way, I think the point that you're saying is we tend to blame ourselves. And in your case, the relief of discovering that it was actually due to the medication meant that you stopped blaming yourself. It's like, it's not me, it's the medication. But I'd even extend that further to people who, you know, maybe there's an aspect in their biology or their history that drives impulses that they can't control. And that, you know, sometimes that can be things like skin picking or hair pulling or, you know, behaving in a way that sort of creates social shame. And in either case, we are all affected by our history and by our biology, and neither of those we have control over. We don't have control over our biology. We don't have control over our history. And I think the problem is when we, particularly with things like, you know, either impulse control disorders or addictive disorders, there is this real tendency to blame ourselves or to blame, you know, to somehow feel like, you know, this is something I should be able to control. So being...
Sorry, go on, Jill.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I felt great relief when finally the neurologist, I saw a new neurologist and she said, she went through my history, which no one had done for some years, and she said, "I'm so sorry this happened to you." I could have cried. And it's I was relieved, but I was also angry. That why did I have to have this for 20 years when they knew all along this could be a possibility, you know? So it's a mixture of relief and anger, but mainly mainly happy.
Thanks, Jill. Thanks for sharing with us too. Yeah, tough. People are often ambivalent, though, aren't they, Sarah, about changing?
Yeah.
You know, they rationally want to change, but part of them doesn't, because maybe part of them thinks, why don't you just love me for what I am?
Yeah, look, it's actually quite hard. I mean, we find particularly if you look at things like addictive disorders and perhaps drinking alcohol is creating problems within the family, or and so there's a sort of a logical part of the brain which is saying this is not good. I really need to stop. And yet there's also you know, we have different parts. Our brain is not sort of this unified one way of thinking. So there's part of us that might feel this resistance. It's like it's almost like somebody else's goal. It's somebody else is putting pressure, and the same may be true with, you know, with gambling or smoking. That there are certain rewards of doing things. You know, even screen time. The rewards are you don't have to face life. You don't have to think about the things going on in your world. You have an escape, and that's a pretty powerful motivator. And especially sometimes if it's other people that want you to change, but, you know, you have that ambivalence, it's actually often very difficult to change.
What do you think's the easiest things to change?
Look, just
giving
very,
up smoking.
Very, no, that's very tough.
Well, no, but in a way, I know it is tough, but in a way it's kind of...
You mean of the addictions?
Yeah, because just because it is a sort of a set little task here and... You know, you can either decide you're going to do it or you're not going to do it. And
you
I know
it's the same with alcohol. You could say the same with gambling.
Yeah, well, maybe that's
I think any of the addictions, and again, there's a lot of individual variation, but for whatever biology or history reasons, for some people, that particular behaviour is really tough to change. And then other people are just, I mean, if you take alcohol, there's a whole lot of people out there who would not care, you know, not care in the world if they never had another drink and get very little joy out of drinking. And other people have such a strong biological drive that once they start, they cannot stop. So there's differences in individual physiology. Look, if you look at what is the easiest thing to change, it's just very specific behaviours that are non-addictive. So it might be things like, you know, the sort of annoying behaviours that people say, like, why don't you just put your dishes in the dishwasher after you've finished eating?
That's true. Yeah.
Or, you know, stop slurping the soup. Or when my friend comes, smile and say hello, you know, just very simple things. Or don't leave your dirty tissues lying around. Or You put the toilet seat down after you've been in the bathroom rather than leaving it up. I mean, those sort of little habits that people can sort of take on board and change. Most of those things are pretty simple because there's no underlying biological drive that sort of really keeps them in place.
Yeah. What about other things though? What about why don't you listen more? You never listen to anybody. I mean, there are many people. I'm sure you've met lots. For example. I meet heaps of people like this who you can have a half an hour conversation with them and they never once ask you a single question about yourself, for example.
Yeah, I think that's a lack of social awareness. It's almost a lack of emotional intelligence. And in fact, my partner and I were in a restaurant. We were waiting for other people to arrive and we could actually hear the conversation of a couple at the table behind us. And this guy was just talking about himself. Like, I sort of started almost laughing just the whole time. And I wanted to turn around and say to him, listen, if you're trying to impress this lady, ask her a few questions about herself.
Ask her a few questions.
Yeah, so it's sort of this lack of emotional intelligence and lack of sensitivity that you know that some people feel that, you know, their role is just to talk at other people without sort of reciprocating.
Do women have a harder time of it? My texter says, I think as women we generally are forced to change by social constraint. We go from being daughters to girlfriends, wives, then mothers, which not only changes the way we act but also our bodies physically, which also leads to a devaluation of ourself, which only compounds as we get older. We're constantly being told that we can be better through the media. When we finally get to a point where we can actually find we can become ourselves, it's in the latter years.
I think it's certainly true that women have more I think, social pressure and expectation to be physically attractive, and I think that makes it harder. And you have to be very confident and have very good self-esteem to not be affected by that, and to not sort of feel the pressure to try and, you know, to become self-conscious about your appearance or to spend a long time trying to maintain your appearance. Look, I think probably both genders have different types of pressure, and I think men also have certain pressures and expectations within relationships.
Just getting back to the listening thing, I mean, this is about changing aspects of your personality, I guess, such as, you know, being a poor listener or being a very angry person or being extremely shy or being self-centred. They're essentially personality traits, aren't they? And maybe this is the hardest thing to actually change, is it?
Yeah, well, you're talking about innate wiring in a sense. So if you look at something like introversion and extroversion, that's one of the sort of the key personality traits. Even things like neuroticism versus being sort of very easygoing, that's a personality trait. And anybody, I mean, the word neuroticism is sort of a terrible word because it's associated with, you know, I guess it's quite derogatory sort of associations. But it actually is a real thing that some people are neurotic by, you know, just by temperament. And it's a temperament that you might pick up, you know, when a child is very young. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of work to change aspects, those sort of aspects of personality, or somebody who has a very irritable temperament, and some people do, and just get triggered very easily. Mm. And often these people know that that is an antisocial trait. It's a trait that will lose you friends or it'll keep people away because nobody wants to be sort of walking on eggshells. Look, they can be modified to some extent. Mm-hmm. A lot of this comes down to self-awareness and working on change and putting a lot of effort and self-awareness into trying to change. But it's tough. If it's part of your personality and it's sort of how you've been habitually for 20, 30, 40 years, it's not an easy thing to change.
Mm. Sarah Edelman's with us, clinical psychologist, and we're talking about whether it's possible to change or is it ever easy to. Lou says, I disagree with you about questions, Phil. Other than for glib topics, I only absorb volunteered info because I never pry.
Say that again. I only absorb
volunteered information, things I'm told.
Oh.
I never pry.
Oh, okay.
I don't know, Lou. I think sometimes if you ask someone a question,
yeah,
that can be very flattering for a person, can't it?
Yeah, I think it is really boring to feel that you're a sounding board for somebody.
Yeah.
So good social dynamic is that we exchange information, that we communicate, that we listen. And as the person's talking, we're listening to what they're saying, we're formulating ideas, and then we provide feedback, and it's sort of an exchange. And so that roughly 50% of the communication is being done by both sides. And when you have just somebody talking at you for a prolonged period of time, it is tedious. And it also feels invalidating. It feels like your opinion and who you are really doesn't matter.
I've often mentioned this to people who feel shy in social gatherings. Maybe that's because I'm a professional question asker. I said it's a really simple trick,
and that
it always works. Yeah. I said, just ask someone a question. It could be anything, like what did you do today, or how was your day, or what's your job, and then from there, I said, you're going to get it. You're going to get 15 or 20 minutes conversation out of anybody, because at heart, people are more comfortable, do you think, talking about themselves than they are about anything else?
Yeah, and we liked it. It's a form of acknowledgement. Actually, it's interesting. On the way here, I actually got a taxi here tonight, and the taxi driver said, you know, how was your day? And I started talking, and it was kind of an exchange. If he hadn't asked that question, I would have just sat there in silence and looked at my phone.
That's it.
So it's telling me this person is making an effort and they're interested, and that's a nice feeling.
Jenny from Albany Creek. G'day, Jen.
Oh, hi. I have a little grandson who will be turning 10 in later on this year, and he's always been a very nervous little guy, but lately he started banging his thigh with one fist, and the other day when I was over there he did it for about an hour or so, and his parents seem reluctant to see a doctor or a paediatrician about it. What can I do to help? If anything.
Yeah, Jenny, that's really tough to witness that, and especially if that sort of seems like a sign of distress.
It's a nervous reaction, I think.
And I guess also, how long has that been going on for him? Because sometimes kids will just engage in that sort of behaviour and then it'll just stop.
I hope it'll just stop. Yeah. It's the first time I'd noticed that. But as I said, he's a very nervy little boy.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't really get on well with other children.
Mm.
And also, when I was over there the other day, he was going through tons and tons of tissues and just wiping his nose. He didn't have a cold.
Yeah. Mm.
But he's just what he had rubbed his upper lip sort of red just by this continuous wiping, and his father said, oh, he's been doing that for about a week or so.
Mm. It's hard, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, it can be like an obsessive compulsive disorder. It's hard to know. But look, hopefully the parents will take, you know, perhaps at some stage.
Yeah, they should, shouldn't they?
Well, I think if it's sort of, it's an ongoing sort of type of behaviour and it manifests in different ways, sometimes at least just getting some advice on the sort of things they can do. Sometimes parents are unwittingly doing things that may be sort of contributing to anxiety or, you know. In an ideal world, it would be good for him to, you know, for them to sort of get some professional advice.
You do think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Could it be sort of one of the autism spectrum behaviours? I've often wondered, actually, if he is on the spectrum, but once again, they don't want to get him tested.
Yeah, so. It's hard to say. It's hard to say without, you know, without sort of getting him tested, but... yeah, look, I think at some point it'll get to the stage where the parents themselves will feel that they do need to get some professional advice.
Because sometimes if you want help, a diagnosis is a good thing.
Yeah, and then once you get the diagnosis, you sort of get strategies and then you get advice.
You get access to help too.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jenny. Thanks for sharing with us.
It must be tough as a grandma.
It's tough as a grandma.
Because you can't really do anything other than try and encourage your kids to take action.
Personalities change over time, don't they? I mean, if you're an angry person, I mean, as we've discussed, when you get older,
And in fact, the research shows that actually negative traits diminish with age. And here are the things that change. As we get older, people get more emotionally stable, more agreeable and sort of pleasant to deal with, and thirdly, more conscientious with time. So
really?
That's what the research shows. And look, it can be sort of partly affected by having a family. I'm just thinking about some good friends of ours who had a child who was very a bit wild and sort of a real worry for the family. And then as he got older and he sort of got into trouble with all sorts of things, and he ended up going to Western Australia, he got married and he had kids, and this guy just totally stabilised and became a really responsible father and became, you know, a loving parent and was working and getting good income. So sometimes people just stabilise with time. One of the things I'm often intrigued about was when I talk to people who've had abusive parenting. So their parents were abusive or neglectful or really punitive when they were kids. And the weirdest thing is that they become loving grandparents. And you sort of think, how do they, you know, what happened then? You know, that they were really, really terrible as parents, but very loving as grandparents. So, you know, whether that's because they're sort of stabilising with old age, or maybe because they're no longer sort of under the pressures of being a parent. I mean, certain parenting has a lot of pressure and demands on it.
If you are unhappy with some of the behaviours of someone as close to you, so you know your partner or a child, now what? Because this is the money question in a way. Is then what sort of things can you do that might encourage them to change? For example, is an ultimatum a good thing?
Look, it depends on the behaviour and how adversely it affects yourself and others. Mm. I mean, if they're doing things that are just affecting, let's say they have a terrible diet and they're really overweight and they're not looking after themselves, I mean, that would be heartbreaking and you want to have conversations because you want the person to be well and to be able to do things and enjoy life. So, you know, communication is always the key, but communication that is open, that is non-threatening, that encourages the other person to reflect on, you know, what they think. Sometimes having a really good conversation can actually encourage the other person to, you know, to clarify what's important to them. Mm. I think that's a completely different situation, though, to say somebody who is gambling and is gambling away the family income, you know, which you know sometimes happens to people, and it has significant consequences on everybody, not just themselves, or somebody who perhaps has an alcohol problem and is abusive when they drink. And I think that's a whole different ball game. I think, again, communication is really important. And at some stage, you may need to talk about consequences. It's interesting with things like
how do you make consequences not threats?
Yeah, I mean, at some point, you may say, look.
If you don't change, I'm leaving.
Yeah,
I'm leaving.
I suppose that's a threat. It's interesting with, say, alcoholism, that sometimes people actually have to hit rock bottom, and that is where their partner leaves. They've got no, you know, they're living alone in a, you know, single bedroom flat, and they're miserable, and they realise that alcohol has totally ruined their life, and they are absolutely desperate and determined. And then from that point, they start going to AA meetings every day, and you know, they really sort of desperately start working to change things. And sometimes people do have to experience really tough circumstances before they are motivated to change. And the same thing is with gambling as well. I mean, at some point people need to take responsibility for that, and it may be getting very intensive therapy and going to Gamblers Anonymous and doing a whole lot of things like giving up credit cards and giving somebody else power over their finances.
How many chances do you give someone?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I mean, I guess that's something that you have to evaluate based on your own experience. At some point, you actually may realise this person is not going to change. This person.
So it gets back to this question that I was going to ask you too, which is that common observation that you can't change anybody. That they the only way that change happens is if people change themselves.
I think it's a bit simplistic, because if you're in a loving relationship and they can see that you're suffering and they really care about you, sometimes that is a motivator for people to really desperately want to change. It's like, I can't stand, you know, sometimes people say, I hate myself, I can't stand what I'm doing to myself, I can't stand what I'm doing to my family. I think you can certainly influence people and you can support them and you can guide them sometimes if they're at least open to having the conversation. The worst thing is when people are completely closed or they walk away or they're not prepared to discuss it. I think, you know, that's when you sort of come to dead ends.
Mary's in Coffs Harbour. Sorry, Mary, you've had to wait on there. Hello.
Hello, yes. I was going to tell you about my experience. I travelled the world and single and everything. Then I got married and had three daughters. The second one's got Down syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the first to go to primary school here. And, you know, I had to start to stand up for her because, you know, they weren't used to people like her going to school, and there was people that were a bit anti. And then I had to start fighting for this, that, and the other for her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's made me more confident in myself in many ways. But then I realised that the love that she shares with so many people, it was just, for me, it was just something, you know, so wonderful that I could share her love.
Mm.
And most recently, you were talking about people changing and getting off alcohol and that sort of thing. Well, her influence has got one of her support workers off drinking. Not only her, but she got her mother off alcohol too. And I can't explain it really fully, but it's just there's something in her. She always knew her support workers if they had trouble at home or something, and she would say, come here and give them a hug. And I've also read recently about we've all got different things. Like a blind person can often have high sense of smell and everything to compensate.
That's right.
Many people with disabilities have other things that compensate for that disability.
But what you're saying, Mary, is looking after her and changed you as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Just caring for her.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's right. Yeah, well, I mean, that's in a sense what you were saying.
Yeah. And also, I guess what Mary's also saying is, even with the support workers, that sometimes when we're sort of engaged and doing sort of good things and dealing with someone who's vulnerable and yet loving and warm, that can sometimes motivate us to want to be, you know, want to be a better person, like Jack Nicholson said. I mean, if you're sort of connected with someone who you know, you have warm feelings towards. So that's lovely.
When someone repeatedly promises they'll change but they haven't, does that suggest they're not likely to?
Sometimes you just have to look at their pattern of behaviour or past behaviour. And again, for something like, say, domestic violence, or somebody who's just, you know, has a history of lying, or someone who has a history of philandering and or gambling or whatever it is, and keeps saying, you know, I'll change, I promise I'll change, and they don't, it certainly would... you know, would suggest that this is not something that you can trust at some point. And I think it was the question you asked before, Philip, you know, at what point do you sort of realise, you know, this is not going to happen? And usually it's when there's a whole history of promising that they'll change and they don't. And at some point, you know, you need to then make a decision about what, you know, where do you go from there and how do you manage this from there? But it's usually not a good sign.
No, exactly. Stephen Parks. G'day, Steve. Hello.
Dr. Clark, I presume. How are you?
Indeed, Professor Steve. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. And g'day, Dr. Edelman.
Hi, Stephen.
Look, I wanted to put something forward, something that's been around for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
What about faith as a catalyst for change?
Yeah.
I read a statement once on faith itself. And I struggled with it myself for a long time. The statement was, I was looking at it, you know, from a person's point of view on the international stage, who was I to challenge something that works for millions of people right around the world, that not only gives them strength, but a code for living. It could be any of the faiths. It could be Buddhism. In our case, I think still to this day, despite the controversy, the Christian faith through the Holy Bible. Like, you can't pick it up without a change in your life. I claim progress. I don't claim perfection. I have my stuff-ups, bloopers, blunders, and failings on a daily basis. But it teaches you to never give up, despite the number of times you fail. The biggest one we can do is give up trying.
Okay. What do you reckon?
Religious
faith?
Yeah, for people who have religious faith, that can be a really useful thing in terms of perhaps...
As a way of changing.
As a way of changing and perhaps getting strength to change when change is difficult. So it can be, you know, can certainly be very helpful for some people.
Yeah, no, good point. Point, Steve. Thank you for raising it. Roger from Box Hill says, great topic. Is OCD, that's obsessive compulsive disorder, classed as an addictive disorder?
It's a compulsive disorder.
Right.
So it's you're driven to do things. And the interesting thing about OCD is people will often tell you that they know their behaviour is irrational, but it is such a the drive is so strong that it sort of seems overwhelming, and sometimes it can completely take over people's lives. So you may find yourself sort of repeatedly checking or ritualising or you know, avoiding things to the point where it's almost impossible to have a normal life. Mm. And the rational part of people's mind knows that that's, you know, that that's irrational and unnecessary, but it's just a drive that's that comes from certain parts of the brain and very, you know, can be very challenging. And
if you want to do something about it, if you don't like something about yourself and you do want to change, just speaking of, you know, like yourself, what can you do?
Well, I think the first thing is to know yourself.
Self-awareness,
to understand, first of all, why do I behave this way? Why do I feel this way? Where does this come from? Know a little bit about your history. It's interesting because my main model or mode of practice is cognitive behavior therapy, and I've always sort of believed historically or traditionally that you don't need to worry too much about history. You just really want to get people to identify what are their thoughts, their beliefs, and challenge them. And now, of course, we know that that's not true. We know that history really does matter. And history is important because it helps us to know ourselves, to understand what underlies and underpins some of our drives, our reactions, our behaviours. I think it's important to identify what the new behaviour is, how you would like to change. So clarify what are your goals, what is it that you would like to change. The other thing that is really helpful is, and I guess it's part of knowing yourself, is mindfulness, but not necessarily so much as a meditation, but just monitoring and being present with yourself. So just noticing what's happening for me right now, what's going on in my body. How am I feeling? Always look to the body, because a lot of the drive that you feel or the compulsion that you will feel inside your own body. It's tension, it's tightness, it's discomfort. It's a biological sort of agitation. So learning to observe that, see it in yourself, and even learning to observe it without judgment. So just allowing yourself to experience some of that drive without always trying to immediately, act to make it go away. Mm. And then things like just finding information, seek information, find resources, find tools, go online, look at how other people overcome the same issues. And sometimes we need to get support, and that can be professional help, or it can be family and friends, talking to other people who are also trying to change, or even finding support groups, sometimes online support groups, sometimes face-to-face support groups. So making it a project and really putting, I guess, a lot of energy into making a difference.
Mm. David from the Hume. G'day, David.
Oh, g'day, Phil. How are you?
No, pretty good.
Just relating to our guest there, I have a 25-year-old now from the age of 14.
Mm-hmm.
He ran away when he was 14, and he turned 25 last week, and we actually hit rock bottom in our relationship. I'd hate to say that I've given up, because I haven't. I struggled as a younger teenager myself, adulthood, with a lot of depression and marijuana. So he sort of suffers himself. But I've always been there for him, and he just hasn't made any effort to try to help me, to help himself. You know what I mean?
Yeah, mm. David, that is really tough. And actually, it's those years from about 15 to 25 in particular where most mental health problems emerge. I think something like 75% of all mental health problems emerge in that period. And if he's being, you know, difficult, or, you know, the relationship is really difficult, often that reflects this, perhaps his own state of mind and mental health issues. Sometimes when people are very difficult, the only thing that you can do is be a constant presence in his life. You do need to set boundaries if some of his behaviour is unacceptable, but at the same time, try to just be a constant supportive presence in his life. And with age, hopefully he will improve. And from time to time, you need to ask him how you can support him and what sort of things you can do to help. But it is very tough, and I'm sure there are a lot of other listeners out there who can totally relate to what you're saying, and the real challenges of being a parent, especially when things get rocky like that, is not easy.
Yes.
Yep. Thanks, David, and yeah, good luck with it too. Yes, self-belief. Do we have to accept that sometimes there are things that we can never change?
Oh, we'd like to think that everything was changeable. but look, it's probably not the case, and there are some things.
What's that line about knowing what things can change and what things can't, and having the wisdom to know the difference?
Yeah. And some things, even things we don't like about ourselves, and it might be, you know, weight issues, or it might be shyness or insecurities or whatever, you know, aspects that come from our history and you know, biology. And sometimes we do have to accept that is part of who I am, and still have self-compassion for yourself, still, you know, not judge yourself, not vilify yourself, not hate yourself for it, but to actually have self-compassion and, if appropriate, to continue to work on it.
Mm. Accept yourself as you are.
Sometimes that's what you need to do.
I always like to return to those wonderful words of the Scottish poet Robbie Burns, who in his famous poem, you might recall, finished it by saying, "Oh, would some power, the gifted guest, to see ourselves as others see us."
Mm.
It would free from many a blunder, free us.
So
self-awareness is so important, isn't it? And getting there itself can be a journey.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
Good stuff. Sarah, always terrific to have you in. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Sarah Edelman is a clinical psychologist, author of Change Your Thinking, amongst other books as well.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.